Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to the Star Chamber Show, episode number 98. Episode 100 is very close now, and I'm Steven Zimmer, and I am here right now with the one and only Daniel Dark and the one and only Michael West. So, hey guys, let's hear from you.
Hey, how's it going
tonight, Steven?
Not bad. It's the calm before the big winter storm. So tonight we actually have decent weather across the bluegrass. It's actually mild and somewhat warm. So I'm going to enjoy it before we get hit by like 6 inches or whatever. It's coming in on Friday.
Yeah, it's between now and Sunday, it's a 60 degree difference here in Indianapolis. It's, it's 57 right now. And it's going to get down to minus 3.
Oh,
yay!
Yeah. Oh, man.
I'll stay in Tennessee. That's like...
So at least here on a Star Chamber show, you can get your Indiana, Kentucky, and Tennessee weather reports all at once.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
It was 60-something degrees here today, so... Yeah, we'll take it. I sat outside and worked for a while today.
Yeah, we did some of our errands, and we're definitely going to be doing some more here because this weekend we're going to be bunkered down, and I guess that's what I'll put on the afterburner on some online stuff and computer work because we're not going to be going very far, not going to be going too far this weekend. So
yeah, it always amazes me. It always amazes me how snow suddenly makes people want French toast. Because the stores are always hit for bread, eggs, and milk.
Oh, man. I don't mind. I'm always up for some sausage biscuits, and usually they aren't wiped out, so I'm usually okay. But we will have – I do want to report that Holly will finally return, it looks like, next week. She's pretty close to being ready tonight, but we're giving her another week to recover before she gets to holler online again. So she will be back next week, but want to give her.
I'm
going to
go to her
that.
In here before the night's over.
You're
I'm
going
to go to her in here before the night's over, man.
She won't listen to me, so if anybody can do it, it's you. Dubious wants to be in the show tonight. He just came up in the studio here and is edging in on my right arm here. He's like demanding to be on the show, I think. And for those of you who don't know, Dubious is a cat, but he's a very, very much a showmanship cat. So we'll have to have the episode, the critter episode of Star Chamber Show. We'll have King Caesar and Dubious co-host that one. And then we'll have a few of Daniels jump in there.
There you go.
Yeah. My two and everything, they don't hardly speak on cue. They only speak when you're wanting to do something else.
Right. Yeah, we actually had Dubious in the last Creatives Cauldron show that we aired, and he actually sat still for an entire segment. It was extraordinary. It was quite a good moment for his showmanship career. So how have things been? Well, I know that we've all been battling illnesses and things like that recently, but as far as our creative endeavors, Michael, we have not gotten here from you in a while. Get us up to speed before we tackle our topic of the evening.
Certainly. I had a short story come out right around Christmas. It's available as a digital download through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, iTunes Books.
Yep.
Kobo.
Yeah.
It's just is 99 cents in the U.S., and I understand from my faithful readers in Canada it's a little bit more up there. But they say it's well worth it, so that was nice. the story is called The City. The story is called The City Will Eat You Alive, and it has been nominated as one of the best horror short stories of 2017 in the annual PNE Readers Poll, which is open until this Sunday. So if you read the story and you want to vote for it, by all means, go to the PNE Readers Poll and cast your vote for The City Will Eat You Alive.
Yes, it's a brilliant story. It's got that whole vibe that kind of, I guess, as you were kind of describing it, before that kind of 1980s horror movie kind of horror feel to it, and you kind of encapsulated that into your flow.
It's a monster story, and it pulls no punches, but it remind, you know, the flavor I was going for was that early 80s, going to the video store and renting a horror movie that you may have only read about in Fangoria, but it didn't play in your theater, so you wait till video.
Right.
To go and pick it up, kind of like Deadly Eyes or Chud or those. I really wanted it to have the flavor of those films.
Oh yes, yeah, those are masterpieces and two of my all-time favorites, as a matter of fact. And I definitely agree with your assessment. It's got that kind of flow and vibe, but just really, really cool story. And it's a nice tied me over sort of thing for your readers as you work on your next magnum opus. So that's a cool thing of you to do. And you've kind of elbowed me to get a few things like that out there myself. So.
Yeah.
I think that was a really good thing to do in between big releases to get this out. I think that was cool. It was the right thing to do for your readers.
You know, Stephen, about writing the epic long format novel.
Mm-hmm.
This is new territory for me because I'm actually wrapping up a series. So I'm finding. Getting the climax that everybody's waited for these last, 7 years, I guess. People have waited for the legacy of the gods to come to its ultimate battle and climax, and that's what I'm working on, and I'm trying to deliver the good. So it's taken me some time. Hopefully it won't be a George R. R. Martin kind of thing.
Well, I was about to say, you got your whole series out at the time one interval of a George R. R. Martin novel and a Song of Ice and Fire series.
This is true. This is true. But I want to make sure that everybody's questions I don't want to be a lost. where everybody's like, but they didn't answer this, they didn't answer that. I want to answer all the questions that everybody has had over these the last three novels, and send off these characters in a really, really grand fashion. So it's taking a little bit longer than the normal book, but I hope. To have it done late this year, so that we can hopefully see it available for you guys to read later this year. But even if that doesn't happen, I will make sure to kind of parcel out some tidbits like this last story, so that everybody's appetite for Michael West fiction gets satiated to some degree.
Very cool. No, it's a good approach to have, because it's definitely, you definitely want to take time. You do not want to rush something like that, the grand finale of a great series. So it's, everybody understands,
yeah,
you got to take the time you need.
Yeah, because I've been reading series before, and you can tell when I'm lucky that I have a publisher who lets me you know, get things right and doesn't, you know, hey, we got a deadline. You need to get that in. You need to get that in. So I'm
right.
Very grateful that, you know, the Seven Star Press does afford its authors a lot of creative, you know, room for creative expression and to be able to do the stories right rather than just, you know, put out there slop,
right,
for want of a better term. But I've read series before where I've been totally into it. And you can just tell that, you know, book four or book five or whatever, that they felt like they had to get something out there. And it just, you could just tell that it was a real dip in the series. And everybody has always commented so far on my books that each book is better than the last. I don't want to ruin the trend.
Yeah, you want to keep that trend going. That's a good one.
Right.
Oh, man. And we have Will Hutcherson in the chat room. So a quick shout out to Will. He's hanging out in the chat room tonight. Yeah, hopefully we'll get a few more chatting it up here as we get underway here. But, yeah, but as far as
Will
shows,
can hang out in the call room
with,
if he wants to.
But with you, you have one of the most unexpected developments in writing lairs, Michael. I mean, man, I hope you do like a video tour of that for YouTube, because I love your setup now. I mean, with your whole realm. It's not even like a writing room. It's a realm, I think, based on everything I've seen down there.
My wife calls it the Buca di Beppo of horror. Because there's just stuff everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Very conducive to imagination.
Yeah.
I need to get me a butler. I need to get me a butler.
Yeah, I got my little he's holding my drink right now, as a matter of fact. My little skeleton butler. It is really conducive to creativity, that's for sure, because you can look anywhere and in the room and find something to spark the imagination. You know, it's like growing up, I always used to watch, you know, on HBO the Ray Bradbury Theater, you know, and you'd see his office, or you'd see pictures of Stephen King's office, and you'd see like all the cool stuff that they just had like everywhere. And that's kind of what I was going for, was just, you know, some, you know, displaying my collection, of course, but also just to have that place that would inspire me and, you know, kind
right.
of recharge my batteries when my fortress of solitude.
Yeah, mine's still the same. It's just an ancient computer that I use strictly as a writing computer, surrounded by piles of CDs and vinyl.
That's pretty
much, or as Holly describes it, the nightmare, even though I do know where everything is. It's spooky. But most people would not have a, they would look at it and go, how the heck do you find whatever you're looking for on music? And I know exactly where it all is, but my writing room is a bit overwhelmed with musical stuff. But it's fun though. Yeah, I know what you mean. You get in that space and everything clicks in. So it does the same sort of thing for me too, even though it's not nearly as cool as yours.
Well, it's hopefully I'm hoping to get the last little bit of construction stuff done this weekend on it, but it's weather depending. So if we get like a foot of snow, like some people have said that we're going to get, then it's going to have to wait a little bit. But hopefully the last little bit of construction stuff gets done this weekend, and then it's just a matter of hanging stuff.
Yeah. Well, the horror writer, when you say hanging stuff, we never know what you really mean.
posters and shelves is what I was referring to. But anyone who's ever done a large framing project knows just how expensive picture frames are. I'd like to be able to wave a magic wand and just have everything, you know, in its place, but just on a writer's budget, just have to do it a little bit at a time.
Right. What, you mean that the writer's budget isn't, like, luxurious and overflowing, coffers-wise?
Yes, this is one of my five homes I have around the world.
Right. Oh, man. I know the pain. And actually, funny thing was, our topics recently when we tackled some of the stuff, you know, with the big sites doing stuff that make our lives harder, we were covering some of those themes. The CEO of Smashwords wrote a great kind of like article statement that is addressing precisely that. And it's like his New Year's kind of like manifesto. And it was just talking about that whole thing, you know, with the concentration of, you know, kind of dominion into a few hands, and then those few hands are making life harder for the rest of us.
Right.
So, yeah, we actually did have, it was kind of interesting because we had been talking about that for the last, in various forms. I mean, that theme has been coming back up several times, and that definitely impacts our, as we were saying, our ability to have the lucrative lifestyle that we indie authors have.
Yeah.
I'm hoping definitely in 2018 that we see some significant changes on that front, where it shakes up a little bit and gets not so hostile to, you know, our ability to do what we do. Because it's crazy. I mean, just the other day we had another author I heard from. I won't put anybody on the spot, but they had two reviews on their new book too, and one of them got taken down because the person was connected to the reviewer on their Facebook profile and Twitter. It's the only possible reason that the review could have been taken down, but they've never met in person. They've never, it's strictly a reader and a blogger on one side and an author on the other side. They have no, like, deep friendship, long personal history, nothing. It's strictly, strictly connected online. And that's the only reason possible why Amazon would have yanked the review down. And it was a brilliant review.
It's just,
really
it's just,
well written,
it's just
well
crazy.
Thought out. Just, yeah.
It's just
because
you as an artist, you need to build your fan base, and to do that, you use the social media, you know, the Twitter, the Facebook, the Instagram, whatnot. And so you're going to have your followers, and you want to have your followers. But if those followers then, buy your book and want to write a review, it's taken down because they have a connection to you. Well, yeah, they have a connection to you, but the connection is just you wrote it, they read it. That's that's the connection.
That's literally
it. You know?
And in this case, it was verified purchase and everything. I mean, there wasn't any legitimate reason why that review shouldn't have taken down. And this poor guy, you know, he's finally got two reviews up, and one got yanked down. And it was a well-written review. I mean, and that really is awful for the reviewer too, because they take a lot of time to craft a review like that. This is a true in-depth critique review, and it was very well thought out. And man, I tell you, that just burns, because I see it going on all the time lately. I mean, it's almost like you gotta kind of keep one eye behind your back and one eye forward as you're working, you know, in this business. And that does get a little bit into our topic for tonight, which is, the unexpected that rises up and how you respond to that once you're underway. And, I know Michael and I both have, several titles out, and Daniel now has his, it's underway as of October with his first title out. So he's just starting to, get hit in the face with the unexpecteds. And Michael and I have dealt with a few of them along the way as we've gone down the road. That's definitely one of the unexpecteds that I have not enjoyed too much. And that's, these sites that, suddenly start playing games like that. I think it was yesterday, the new Goodreads policy, I think, was kicking in, or where they're making authors pay to do giveaways on Goodreads. I swear, it just gets crazier and crazier. But, that was, I think, January the 9th, I think that policy was supposed to lock in, from what their statement had said. So, yeah, you even got to pay to give a book away on Goodreads, and pay dearly if you want to give away even one copy.
That's crazy.
Oh, man. But, yes, the unexpected. And let's get into that a little bit. I know Daniel really had an interest in this particular topic, so maybe you want to kick it off with a few comments and notes on this.
Well, the first thing that I look at is the fact that you have to be responsible for your own creativity. If you're not responsible for it, then who are you going to find that will be responsible for your creativity? And part of what I'm talking about on that is also the other work that is involved in making your things come to life, whether it's artwork that you're doing, whether it's books that you're writing, movies that you're making, what, you know, all the other things that have to be done for that, whether it's like we're talking about just then, on being able to do giveaways. Okay, Goodreads wants to charge you money. You don't have the money to spend to Goodreads. Where else are you going to do that at? Go find someplace else to do it at. If you're sitting there just complaining about the things that are going on without a solution,
right,
then you're not taking responsibility for what you're doing. And
yeah,
we hear so many times
right.
where somebody will complain about it, but they won't try to come up with any type of solution to solve the problem.
Yeah.
So.
And that's something that I'm always doing. I mean, whether from a press standpoint or when I'm, you know, representing myself as an author, I'm always trying to think of, okay, well, how, okay, they threw this curveball at us. Okay, how do we get around it? Okay, they did this to us. Okay, how do I do it? Or, you know, how am I going to reapproach this with, you know, some of the obstacles that suddenly manifest? And it's not easy. I mean, and I think that, you know, like I said, with the stuff that goes on Amazon and, you know, just what I think is the awful development of Kindle Unlimited, I think that hurt a lot of authors economically and things like that. I think it's important for authors to make sure they promote the other platforms that their work is on. I mean, I think it's important to emphasize the Kobo Kindle or not Kobo and iTunes and Smashwords and all the other outlets, because yeah, you don't want to see everything get into one under one hat, so to speak. And I mean, it's that's the kind of reaction you got to make. You got to shift and, you know, emphasize new things and kind of make things work as you can. And that's not easy, but that's what you got to do.
Yeah. It's like, you know, when I was looking at myself, I had to ask, you know, what is my commitment to my talent? You know, what am I willing to do for it? And am I willing to commit to, you know, do something that I don't know how to do yet? You know, and sometimes, you know, I have to look at it and say, yes, I need to do that. I cannot, you know, I'm not going to hire somebody to do it, and I'm not going to depend on somebody else to do it, because sometimes it doesn't get done the way you want it done.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know, the commitment to things has to be as strong on everybody else's part as it is on my part.
Right.
You know, that's the reason
I think that's...
enjoy working and starve, because y'all's commitment to me is, you know, I feel is as great as my commitment to me.
Well, that's usually when the best progress is made, is when there's synergy, when you get multiple people that have that mindset and they actually come together for what I call the win-win kind of approach. Yeah, sure, you are doing it to advance your path, absolutely. But then when you kind of bring that kind of same common interest, you know, together with somebody like me working as I have with Michael through the years, or me, you know, working with you now, and when you get a few together on that, it really chugs, and you can see, you know, you can see it, you really can, versus the ones that, you know, just kind of sit in the sideline and wait for somebody else to do everything.
You know, and on top of that, you know, you've got to look at what's your core activity. In other words, what would you do even if you didn't get paid for it? And, you know, with me, it's my writing and stuff like that. I would keep doing it whether I was getting paid for it or not. And, you know, I want to advance my writing, so I have to sit there and do other things to advance that writing and make other things also a core activity that has to be done so that I can do my core activity better.
Right. Yeah, for me, I mean, definitely writing falls in that category. See, things I would do even if I'm not getting paid for it. Drink bourbon, that would fall into that category as well.
you're paying for that one, Stephen. You don't get paid, you're paying for that one.
Not if you're gifted, though. I mean, I got lucky on my birthday and scored a few bottles in one day. So sometimes it works out. that was a very, very, very fun day. Yeah. Definitely. I mean, you have to love what you do. And especially when you're going through the kind of like the leaner road that, you know, most indie authors are on. I mean, because the rewards are definitely not in the financial form. I think I can speak for all of us on that side of the coin. I mean, there's times when, you know, you have a really good sales event. There's times when, you know, you have a good, you know, a good run in a given quarter or something like that. But yeah, it's definitely the dollars are not what's propelling your motivation. That's definitely not the case.
Like the dollars that you give when you're doing movies and stuff like that and TV pilots, you know, but.
Right. Well, that's, the indie world. I mean, you're taking punches on those budgets because, you're having to scrape and cough up as much as you can to finish them and do them. And, you know, and so that can get extra painful because those things always, you know, end up being a lot more costly. I mean, even on the small scale. But you're right. I mean, if you don't love it, I mean, you'll never really get through it or do it well. And,
right.
And I think that's what Michael was saying, you know, earlier when you take your time, you know, your focus is on taking the time to get something done right and not just rushing it out there to be a product, and throw it on a shelf and start, you know, so yeah, when you love it, you take that approach, the Michael West kind of approach that he was talking about, you know, where you want to make sure it's right and your motivation is not just throwing it out there in the market. So that's a good example. But what are some things, Michael, that as you kind of got underway that you did not expect as an author coming in that, you know, you had to really adjust to once you got on the inside of it?
The thing that most surprised me was the fact that how unwilling certain bookstore chains and whatnot are to work with an author. I assumed, you know, being someone who, you know, was a reader wanting, you know, writing, wanting to have my first book out there and going to book signings and whatnot, you know, I just thought that, you know, you had a book, you talked to the bookstore and, you know, they'd set up a signing and, it doesn't work that way. So I've been lucky enough to be able to find ways to make it work. But it was a, you know, kind of a rude awakening. Much of my first go round with my first novel was a rude awakening from the way that the publisher I had at the time took advantage of me to the way I had to try to market myself and you know in a way I after that first experience I could have, you know, gone into a corner and, you know, with my tail between my legs and not written another word ever again. But I, you know, persevered and said, you know what, I'm going to, you know, this was a mistake. This was a bad experience, but I'm going to switch gears and go the short story route and write some short stories and get those into some, you know, magazines that people actually read and try to develop a following that way. And that's what I ended up doing. So
I did it very well.
Well, thank you. But you take you take the punches, and I mean, you got to develop a thick skin in this business, but you take the punches and you roll with them, and you hopefully come out stronger on the other side.
Well said. Yeah, I'm going to let one more person come on and join us right now, because I don't know what happened to Colonel D.R. Acula, a.k.a. Air Jude. He must be having some technical difficulties of some kind, because he has not checked in just yet. But we do have the amazing Will Hutcherson, who is coming online as of right now. There he is.
Hello, hello.
Will, there you are.
Hey.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Right.
Good to hear from you again, Will.
Well, that's nice to hear. I'd like to bring the conversation back to a point that Daniel brought up earlier about responsibility for many things in the business, personal responsibility. And one of the things he mentioned having personal responsibility was your own creativity. And while I agree, I'm also on the fence of how many genre tropes you can include when you write genre fiction or speculative fiction. Like what does it take to get an audience thinking your attempt at creating something that is kind of like an orc but not an orc, convincing them that it isn't an orc, for example. You know, some expendable meat wall that you can just put in front of the hero. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah,
I'm reading through Robert Jordan's series right now, and he managed to do it, but I can't imagine the effort that it took him to just get that slight advance, that slight nudge into being close to something but not easily recognized as a trope, for instance. I hate using that word, but, I mean, what is an orc but a trope?
What is an orc but a trope? You want to respond to that, Michael?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've ran into that over the years as well. You know, it's, you know, when you write horror, you or sci-fi or fantasy, any you know, genre fiction, romance, you know the tropes, you know them inside and out, and you use them, and to some extent the readers can be kind of the same way, in that they'll go along with you because, okay, people act this way because it's a horror movie. You know, or it's a horror book, you know, so I'm used to reading horror books and watching horror movies, so I expect people to act a certain way, which is why I started branching out with my pre-readers and getting people who don't necessarily like or read horror fiction to read my stuff and comment on it, just simply because, you know, if you don't read, if you haven't experienced much horror fiction, and you don't even really necessarily like horror fiction, but you're just basically reading it because I did it, you know, but you bring a whole nother skill set to it, in that you can challenge me and say, well, why did so-and-so do this? Well, they did it because they have to do it because they have to get into the dark house somehow. And it's like, well, that's stupid. Nobody would do that. You know, and they kind of challenge you to find different ways. Right.
That was a great way to get them into the dark house, you know, by the protagonists, quote unquote, being shitheads who rob blind to write morbid. That was a good way to twist the trope to your advantage. That's part of what made that film so good, other than Stephen Lang's stellar performance as a movie monster.
Right.
It's somehow human. You enjoyed it, right?
Yeah.
You saw it. You saw it, right?
What's that?
Don't Breathe.
Yes.
I saw it. Yeah.
Yeah. I liked it.
Yeah, no, I think I held my breath for that entire 90 minutes of that movie. So,
oh God, it's Stephen Lang in here. Dark. I guess that's one way to turn a trope.
Well, if Michael can hold his breath for 90 minutes, then we need to do that at some book events and really impress people then.
But yeah, you're right. I mean that kind of that movie kind of was standing the thing on its head, the home invasion movie, where normally you've got the defenseless person. A good example of that, which I loved but my wife laughed through most of it, was the stranger.
Usually the home invader is the antagonist.
Right. You've got the antagonist who is the home invader, and they're going to terrorize the homeowner. And that's, you look at that whole genre, and that's what it does. But what Don't Breathe does is it turns it on its head and says, okay, the people who are invading the home, they're the ones who are in trouble. They're the ones in danger. They have no idea what they're getting into. And it just totally turns it on its head and makes it into something, elevates it above the other films in the genre.
Oh, remember, they did know what they were getting into. They researched him beforehand. They just underestimated him blind.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, they researched what they had access to, but they had no idea what was actually going on.
they don't know that he knows Krav Maga. They can still perform it while blind.
yeah.
But, well, sometimes, you can take tropes and just use them as a springboard for the narrative itself, and usually that's done very well in, comedy, horror, and comedy. Because I haven't seen it yet, but you've mentioned Orcs. They got maybe one of you guys have seen it, but the one with Will Smith on Netflix. It's called Bright.
Yes, Bright.
Bright. Yeah.
I'm so leery. I want to watch it, but I'm like, oh, it's Will Smith though. He's not good anymore.
Well, see, I was interested in it because the first version of the screenplay was written by Max Landis. And if you're a fan of Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency and whatnot, you know just how wonderful his writing can be. But from what I understand, it was, it went through his draft went through several rewrites because my son was telling me that he watched someone kind of dissect it and go through Max Landis's draft of the script compared to the final shooting draft of the script and all the discrepancies and differences and where they changed it and, not for the better. But from what I've, people who've actually seen it, who I, respect their opinion, it's basically, turn off your brain and just, it's a fun time. So I'm curious to see it.
It's getting a sequel. So apparently it did well enough for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's a good example, I think, of when you can actually take a trope and make use of it overtly, and whether it's parody or a little spinoffy kind of thing, or or a little bit of an homage thing, you can actually take that and run with it sometimes, so you don't even have to sometimes even twist it like they did in Don't Breathe, from what I was hearing from you guys, but you can sometimes actually use it as kind of like the core itself, the trope, so to speak, becomes, a bit of the object itself.
Yeah, because, horror and comedy is kind of a tight rope there are a lot of movies who have done it well, but then there's a lot of movies that have really, really
broken to the ground.
Yeah. I mean, one of my all-time favorite films is Evil Dead 2, and that's, hysterical. It's hysterical.
Mm-hmm.
But it also has some pretty scary
moments. It looked at the first one and said, we're not going to be able to do this seriously for another far franchise, so let's just go all the way and be silly with it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the guy who made Don't Breathe made the remake in 2013, I want to say, of the first Evil Dead. That was absolutely terrifying.
Right. Well, and
what was the Michael Winter verdict on that one? now I'm curious. What did you like the reboot, to speak?
I liked the reboot. I still have not seen the unrated version that is available in Europe, and I guess you can get it.
Comes a bit much. I'm not a wuss, but woof.
But
it was a bit much for me, and I can take it.
but I enjoyed that they took some of the set pieces of the first film and kind of revamped it and had their way with it and kind of changed expectations, because it's there again, you're not going to be able to necessarily catch lightning in a bottle again a second time, but take what you did well and just have fun with it and play with it and do different things with it. I enjoyed it for what it was. And, I think it works, on its own, even if you haven't seen any other, the Evil Deads.
Right.
Yeah. So you don't need to watch the others because it's its own story.
Right. Right.
If you watch the others and then you go to this, you will be probably kind of shocked.
Right, right, yeah. It definitely goes to some dark places, that's for sure.
Oh yeah.
But
it took the set, like the volume setting of the original Evil Dead, which I'd say was about a 7 or an 8, and then bumped it up to 15.
Right.
So he liked it.
These go to 11.
Oh, yeah, that's a good movie. They make great horror movies. That's a good production company.
So, Daniel, you've been quiet. did you catch any of these?
I've just been listening. I don't know that I've seen any of the ones that you're talking about except for Evil Dead, back in the day. I haven't seen the new one at all. So,
But by the same token, If you look at fiction, if you apply that, and we were talking about movies, but if you circle around back to fiction, look at what Brian Keene did with The Rising. He took the zombie genre, which the Romero style zombie was what everybody had become accustomed to at that point, and he injected, smart zombies into it, and you wouldn't think just you're like what. But it's absolutely terrifying. It's chilling, and that I don't think Brian gets enough credit for resurrecting, pun intended, the zombie genre. Because there was no zombie fiction really before The Rising, and now look where we are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But that's the challenge with all writers. I mean, it's, because you have such established iconic things like zombies, werewolves, vampires, et cetera. And yet, year in and year out, really good works get released, whether books, movies, games. And, every time, you are dealing with, a creature that has a certain parameters, and it's interesting to see how those boundaries are pushed sometimes, obviously with sparkling vampires in one place, and then here over there you've got a different kind of vamp. The ways in which different creatives try to push the boundaries.
There you've got Interview with a Vampire,
but
vampires beautiful and grotesque at the same time.
But they'll try to push the different areas, and see how far they can go sometimes.
I think that goes back to what we were saying before about being responsible for your own creativity. You can come up with something, an angle that you think is fresh and new, and you're going to be met with some adversity. It's like for right now, if you try to submit a zombie story to places, you'd get a lot of pushback saying, oh, you know, not another zombie story.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want, but if you, you know, if you had a really fresh take on it, you know, and you get it into the right hands of someone who is willing to take a chance on it and take a look at it, you know, that's where you have to persevere. You know, you have to, number one, mm-hmm. you don't want to write to trends anyway, because by the time you get yours thing out there, the trend will be something else. But by the same token, if there is a trend that is, you know, like the zombie craze that's going on right now, and you're writing, you know, a zombie story, just make sure that you have, you know, a very unique take on it that's going to stand out from all the others.
Mm-hmm.
Have you all seen the trailer for Peter Jackson's newest film? It's based off of a book.
Yeah, it's based
part of the Infernal Engines.
Right.
Or whatever it is, Mortal Engines, rather.
I have not seen it yet.
It played in front of Star Wars.
I saw that trailer first in IMAX, and I loved it. It looks delightful.
What is it now?
Well, I'll
let you go ahead. You'll probably explain it better than I will.
Well, it's basically kind of a cross between Mad Max and it's very steampunk in a way, but it's basically the Earth is scorched and cities go around on wheels basically and you know fight and devour other cities.
Yeah, London moves.
Yeah,
beautiful. And they've created the digital reproduction that they've made is absolutely breathtaking in the trailer.
So those cities will also eat you alive.
Yes, they will. Yes, they will.
Yes, they will.
That sounds cool.
Recommend giving that trailer.
There's your series, Michael.
There you go, Michael. Oh
yeah,
my God.
Yeah, but if you can YouTube it, it's worth a watch.
Yeah, I first saw it in IMAX when I went to on my second rewatch of my second watch of Episode 8 when I was in New York. Wow. In IMAX, it looked beautiful.
Yeah, it does.
Well, one thing that I would also throw in the ring here on the discussion is that, you know, even with, you know, the different twists you put on the popular creature or whatever, I mean, still, it's like the way I am when I watch very little TV, but when I do, you know, I'm kind of selective on what I do watch, and it always rotates around, you know, like I said, really compelling characters, and which is
right.
Something that, you know, like I said, does not, it's not beholden to any one genre. I mean, you really, really have to have characters that shine in addition to, you know, these kind of twists, I think, and that's fundamental to the storytelling.
Out the ass.
Within that. And I think a lot of writers sometimes get caught up in the bells and whistles of how cool this is, you know, with the little twist I'm doing on this. And sometimes they miss the forest for the trees and come out with characters that really aren't going to necessarily grab you. And I think that's a...
They get too caught up in minimizing the copycat attacks. The copycat criticisms.
But I think that's something that, you know, I do see, you know, from time to time as well in writers.
One of my big hurdles right now. It's definitely one of my big hurdles.
Trying
to minimize the copycat criticism.
Right. Yeah, I think you just got to barrel through and write write, get that story down when you've got it in your head, no matter what, without panicking too much about, you know, it, you know, something might be out there. It's similar. Cause I think at this point, you know, we're at a stage, you know, with the, I mean, I think you could just do the math on the volume of stuff that's being released every week. Somebody has put something out that's somewhat like what you're doing. I mean, it's just somewhere. I mean, it may not be known, but it's out there. I mean, because there's just such a sheer volume now.
At the same time, you also got to be careful because we're living in the most litigious country on the planet, where even the slightest copyright, something that even looks like something that someone else thought of, can get you sued at the tail. You know.
It can, but yeah, but there's ways to easily defend against some things like that. I mean, if you had something on the other side of the world that came out that, you know, only sold 15 copies, and that, you know, you really can prove that you never, you know, cross paths with it. I mean, there's ways to deal with something like that. I mean, otherwise we'd all be too terrified to put anything out there.
You saw where Stephen King got sued recently for Dark Tower.
Yeah.
Didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
By this comic book creator, while he had a convincing argument, everything would have had to have lined up perfectly for it to be considered the truth. So,
well, what has
King
been unexpected for you,
read
Will?
That comic book.
Oh, I was going to say, you are just getting into this as a you know, a young writer. What's hitting you in the face right now, as far as what's been unexpected for you as you've been getting into this? What's been eye-opening or unexpected?
The absolute lengths I have to go to make sure that my things, some of the things that I base on real, like actual things and places and objects, are as accurate as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Before I put it out, because a lot of people will bitch and moan if something stands out.
Mm-hmm.
That,
so historical authenticity.
Yes. Example, and I've brought this up in arguments and statements before. Military structure. You know, having to research the how buried real life militaries actually were in the Middle Ages. You know,
mm-hmm.
how undisciplined yet cohesive they were. It was a very, like a flock of birds just swaying and bulging in the wind. It was just very strange. Like seeing how disunified people were by their income level. I mean, you know, you have 30,000 different peasants all wielding, you know, shit they made at home.
Mm-hmm.
And you have maybe 20 knights, you know, all in their varied accoutrements,
mm-hmm.
depending on how much they could afford. And that definitely went away as the Dark Ages ended.
Yeah.
But still seeing it.
But for you, it was the amount of research necessary for a fiction project that was the most eye-opening thing for you. How about you, Daniel? Because you write historical set fiction.
I did a lot of research and everything, but I have done research on the subjects for years anyway. So when I started writing, it was not a big challenge to me to know where to find the stuff that I needed.
Mm-hmm.
On that part of it, the biggest things that I've seen since I've, like, since the book's come out and different things like that is, you know, what it takes to get reviews. What does it take to get, you know, book signings? What does it take to do other things that are part of the business that we have to sit there and, you know, deal with? I can't
having,
you know,
to rely on having to rely on your audience to get off their ass and talk about you.
Right. And, you know,
yeah.
And being able to get them to, you know, to give you a review or to, you know, be at a book signing or something like that. And, you know, I haven't had a whole lot of trouble with the book signings in a way because everybody that I've talked to has basically agreed to give me one. But it's just a matter of finding the right places and getting out there and being able to have enough book signings that it's doing you some good and figuring out how to get the advertisement and everything done just right so that you'll have people there to make it profitable to you.
In the political world, they call that energizing your base.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think, too, Michael had brought it up earlier when he was talking about just getting into the early stages of his path as you know, being published and everything. And I saw it too, but you know, there's a lot of change that we saw because we were coming into it at a time when you know, bookstore chains and large bookstores and all were still prevalent, ubiquitous. They were, you know, very powerful still. And, you know, the online world hadn't totally kind of turned everything on its head yet. It was just, it was coming in, definitely. But it had not transformed as it has now, where we have a shift to, you know, maybe less big box kind of stores. And now the bookstores are taking more often the form of smaller indie bookshops, you know, with the exception of maybe like a Barnes & Noble or something. But it's... they're still hanging in there, obviously, but a lot of places, you know, like when Borders closed, things like that, what you had replacing it was small stores, and they have a different dynamic. And so, you know, so for Daniel and you, I mean, yeah, you're entering a slightly different world of that than we did when we started. So,
Stephen, with me, Barnes & Noble has, you know, embraced me without any trouble.
Yeah,
that's where my book signings are happening at right now.
That's
except
where your
for some other places
that
I'm
King, isn't it?
Do what?
Shelf. So that's where your book sat next to Stephen King's newest release on the shelf, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
That'll definitely get
and,
you the ball.
And that depends on
yeah.
a lot in the store managers, because I do know we talked recently with friend author that is in the Northeast, and they had the opposite thing happen when they went set up some Barnes & Noble engagements and were running into a lot of bureaucracy and red tape. Just a different region, so that, you know, but they had a different kind of reaction to indie author stuff. But it's good to, you know, it's good that, yeah, they definitely do, I guess, allow some flexibility with their, you know, with their oh God, I can't remember the term, but they're basically their manager PR people.
Well, and what I've found is that with regard to Barnes & Noble is that if you can find a Barnes & Noble that is a quote unquote college Barnes & Noble, where it's located near a university or services a university or is on a university campus, they're a lot more willing to work with you than the ones that are, you know, in the suburbs or whatnot.
And that makes sense with you, Daniel, because the Vanderbilt location, right? So,
yeah, Vanderbilt's the one's coming up. I had one in Murfreesboro,
uh-huh.
which is out in the suburbs and everything, but MTSU has MTSU, which is the largest student count in Tennessee on a college.
Yeah.
And, you know, different things like that. So that may be true.
Mm-hmm.
But they've embraced me without any trouble. So,
yeah, because the only time I've been able to get an actual Barnes & Noble signing was at the IUPUI here in town, Barnes & Noble, and the they basically, you know, because I asked them, I said, why is it that you're so willing to work with me when I can't get one up in Castleton or some of the other, you know, more you know, prevalent areas, and they're like, going, well, because we're a college store and we have a lot more flexibility.
Yeah, it makes sense. It definitely does. But
EKU.
Yeah, I want to say, oh, a quick shout. Let me do a quick shout out in the chat room to Carol Preflatish. I see she's hanging out in the chat room tonight. A great writer and one of my favorite people around. Yeah, I want to give her a quick shout out there. But back to what you were saying. Also, I think a lot of authors are starting to do more. You know, like Daniel said, when you don't have the availability of as many physical bookstores, you start doing things. Your solution comes in where you start doing things like what Daniel's doing with the cigar shop event that he's about to do, or like what I did once at a liquor store with did a books and bourbon event. You start to do things out of the box. And
right.
And adjust to that when the landscape changes a bit.
I've signed at a haunted house before, so.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I think one of the big potholes that I'm going to have to avoid is resisting the temptation of the digital market. Because I feel like that's a place where I can get trapped very easily into selling my hard-earned work for pennies on the dollar, if that.
You're trapped. Okay, define that just a little bit. What you're worried about exactly what with the digital market?
Having me knowing the value of the work that I've done, and having that needed to be either for free or at pennies on the dollar in order to get someone to take a look at it. No.
Oh man, you just hit on a mother load of fear of the unexpecteds for me. And that was the idea of, you know, when the ebook market came in, the big emphasis on, oh, you gotta give things away for free all the time. You always gotta, you know, always gotta have, you know, 99 cents are free, 99 cents are free. And basically all, you know, what I saw in the aftermath of that whole period was that the whole perception of value of books and ebooks just sunk. And it was really frustrating to watch that happen. And so I'm very cautious about that now. And I think that when like something like Michael's doing, like when you put an ebook short story out, yes, that works. But I don't necessarily think that it's that great when you're constantly putting that, your work out there for free. I think in the long run,
e-book
it actually
stories
is a bit harmful.
Ebook short stories are a great incentive for Patreons.
I think those are strong for those too, but yeah, it's definitely it's a change in perception, and it's something that the major publishers have definitely drawn a line against, because if you look at the major press, I mean, their ebooks are all like $9.99 and up to, you know, as high as $20, or, you know, even I've even seen some higher, I mean, for the ebook versions. And like I said, the Brandon Sanderson novel, you know, when it came out,
I'll
the hardcover edition on Amazon was cheaper than the ebook. It was like $2 or $3 cheaper than the ebook version. And
yeah.
So, you know, so they're aware of this.
I'll give
you know,
them
this perception
that
thing.
That affects our income, and they've chosen to keep it expensive.
Yeah. And they definitely are aware of that perception thing, and I think they're very careful and wary of having people perceive that, you know, a Simon & Schuster release should be free or 99 cents. I think they're very, very careful about that. And I think that's where a lot of indie authors I think we blundered a lot, you know, in that, because there's, you know, just always been that kind of emphasis to give everything away. And that's just not a good thing, I don't think, in the long run. I think it's okay for certain moments or certain targeted, you know, very, very special kind of things, but not as a regular practice. I'm not so sure that's a good thing.
I think the ridiculousness of that phase of the market is emphasized by the completely random success story of The Martian. There was no reason for that. It was just complete luck.
Well, you got a marketing background, Daniel. What are your thoughts on the give everything away mentality?
There is no reason to give your work away, in my opinion. You worked hard on putting it out there. If people do not want to find the value in it, then, you know, I know that I've looked at a lot of it and say they go, you know, well, I've got, you know, so many, I've got 100,000 book sales, which might put you on a list someplace. But if the 100,000 book sales are, you know, at $0, then what have you got?
Right.
You get, you know, you still don't have anything that you didn't have yesterday.
Exactly.
And, you know, that, in my opinion, there's no real reason to give it away for the the financial end of it. Because if you're wanting to do this full time, like I am, I'm wanting to do this full time, I have to address the revenue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have to address what I'm bringing in from the work that I'm doing. And, you know, $0 is still $0 no matter how many you put in there.
Right.
You know, and you sell it for 99 cents and you're getting, you know, what on the 99 cents, you know, because you're not getting the whole 99 cents even, then you're still basically giving your work away. You know, there is a value to the product. If there's no value to the product, why are you doing it?
I would like to point out that I think last week when I was in, fun fact, a Barnes & Noble picking up stuff using money I had over from Christmas as a gift, I was getting the second and third books of Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time series, as I already had the first one. And I looked at getting the hardback of the second one. Even all these years later, that hardback is $40 MSRP in retail.
Yes.
And I looked at it, and the thought that went through my head was, look, I totally get it. It was a lot of work for Mr. Jordan, and it's a hell of a printing job. I mean, it's a big book on the part of the publisher Tor Books. But $39.99 is why people don't buy books anymore.
Yeah, things can be priced too high in a lot of cases, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that
it's a very
it can't
slippery
swing
slope
too high the other way.
So I looked, and then I looked at the paperback, which I've got here with me, $8.99.
Mm-hmm.
Retail in U.S. dollars. And that baffled me. That's a $32 difference.
Well, the thing that you've got to look at on that is, you know, what type of paper is it printed on, what press used. It's a hardback compared to a paperback, which is going to last longer. There's a lot of different things involved in that and what the cost of
that.
Sir?
Yeah, I usually go for hardbacks just for their longevity.
Right, right. And
I can't stand bending of the spine of a paperback. It just rubs me the wrong way.
Mm-hmm. I understand.
Yeah,
like
plus we're in the middle of
sitting in a place the other day, and one of my books was laying there on the table in place of business. And it was dog-eared and stuff like that where the guy had read it, and I'm just there looking at it like,
why don't you buy
okay. The other guy had bought it from me.
That's what I was saying. That's like, that's the thought. I thought you said, meant it was just sitting on like a stand in a venue.
No, it was
all dog-eared.
Sitting on a table and where you could sit down and talk and eat and stuff. So, but it was just, you know, I'm sitting there looking at the book, and it's one of my books, and I'm sitting there looking at it saying, you know, to myself, I am prestige on my books, you know, that I have in, like, my office, you know, books that are in there and everything. A lot of them, even though I've read them, you can't tell that I've ever opened the book.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sitting there looking at one of my books, and it's they're all dog-eared, and I'm like, I do not own that book anymore. I have to let that go. He paid me good money for it.
I mean, I've shared pictures of my bookshelf on social media before, and the only way you could tell I've read some of these books is just by the natural wear on the places where I've held them while reading.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Just from grasping it. Like my copies of The Lord of the Rings, you can't read the titles on their spine from where I've gripped them.
Yeah. Oh, I have copies.
I just
like
know
that
that's what they are.
Well-worn copies. And
well,
thankfully, my trade paperbacks have tend to held up better than my mass market paperbacks in case various cases.
Kidding.
And
your paperbacks are incredible. I'll
and
say
that is actually another change that has happened since Michael and I first were getting published is that, you know, you have a shift in soft covers that where things were pretty much predominantly mass market paperback, and now, you know, the trade paperback is you know, kind of becoming the increasingly seen soft cover format, and definitely is for indie authors and small presses.
The lamination and the embossing and all that stuff.
But you see that. And, yeah, I think it's a pretty good format, nice balance between price point and quality.
Yeah, they're definitely finding it, which is good.
But it's
so I've got an entire collection of Robert E. Howard's work that is all paperbacks, and they're in great condition.
Nice.
Very cool.
Yeah. Now, when you find a collectible version, I mean, that's a whole other subject. I mean, yeah, especially with the specialty presses that do leather, you know, leather bound, you know, hand stitched kind of, you know, editions, and just the really uber premium kind of presentations. I mean, those are a lot of fun.
I told you and showed you the leather bounds that Barnes and Noble does for $15 to $25, depending on what you're getting.
Yeah, now that was pretty cool. Yeah, I remember you showing me those.
Yeah,
I was very shocked at how they were able to, the price point they could sell those at.
Yeah.
Because those were very nice additions.
China.
But as far as that goes, I mean, yeah, as far as the formatting and the formats and stuff, I mean, yeah, you definitely have a shift underway that's happening, and I don't know exactly where it all shake out, but I do think the trade paperback is going to become you know, you're going to see a gradual phase out, I think, of the mass market paperback format.
Standard.
I do think that's going to kind of go by the wayside eventually. But what else? What else do we have as far as like new stuff that kind of caught you guys by surprise?
Do what?
Oh, as far as changes, you know, things that, you know, you're kind of caught by surprise by.
Algorithms, how fast those change every month.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's definitely.
Okay, an algorithm.
You know, you see, and you get used to how they're doing it one time, and, you know, you start adjusting for that, and about the time you get adjusted for it, they changed it again. Which I don't understand enough anyway, so it puts me in, you know, backseat a lot of times. And one of the things that, you know, I'm having to learn or trying to learn a little bit about is the you know, multimedia thing that we call the internet.
Oh, yeah, monstrosity.
And how to use that to benefit me and my books and stuff like that. You know, planting seeds of wonder, you know, for advancement in the future right now. So,
Well, even the way the internet works is changing radically as we speak. I don't want to get political, but no matter what side of the issue you fall on, the official repeal of something as important as net neutrality is going to shock the way it's going to shock the medium completely. You know, it allows your internet providers to pick and choose what data gets used, what websites, what videos, what search engines, anything. I mean, it's very scary.
That is, yeah. Michael and I don't know, Michael, if you want to comment a little bit on this, but yeah, we remember a time when, yeah, even like Amazon's algorithm was friendly to an indie author, and if you got a good little run of reviews, you started to get recommended by Amazon to other book buyers, and it had a real organic kind of development. And when we had our first few books coming out,
right,
the shareholder got nervous about PR. That's where every negative shift has begun, is when the shareholders get nervous about PR.
Yeah, I think I do know that there were some that gamed the system. And Michael and I both saw this, and you know, where you had like a new author come out and they would suddenly have 60 reviews, and they were all 5-star reviews, and they were all like 2-sentence reviews, like within 2 days. And there was some serious cheating going on at that time, you know. But I don't think that, you know, they should have thrown the baby out the bathwater necessarily, you know, because the other authors were, you know, at least able to make an organic amount of progress, and the system did work for them.
So much of the change that you see in different mediums is knee jerk reactions to things. It's like I said earlier, with rolling with the punches, you know, sometimes
those punches are getting harder and harder.
Yeah, some years it feels like you've gone, you know, 6 rounds with Mike Tyson, and
soon we'll be all wondering what our asses, if we're not careful.
Right. It's, it's like the one thing to expect as an author is to expect the unexpected. So like you were saying before, it's like as soon as you think that you've got something figured out, you have to, you know, learn to adjust to a whole new set of rules.
Well, yeah, that's why we adhere to a doctrine of don't be boxed in one thing. Don't have all your emphasis, and you really do have to keep as I would say, a diversified stock portfolio. I mean, you can't have it all in one thing. You've got to spread your activity around in a few different types of spheres and different kinds of spheres, so that when one of those things rises up that you don't expect, it doesn't sink you or impact you in such a way that you're overwhelmed.
At the same time, yeah, work within your means. Don't spread yourself too thin.
No, yeah, that's the fine art. Yeah,
people won't put together the pieces and say, "Oh, this guy is completely related to this thing." His publisher is people that are putting out his stuff. Okay, you know, that kind of deal.
The danger of getting spread thin is awful for authors, especially in social media.
Oh yeah,
I mean you can destroy an entire day. Just, you know, doing postings and this and that, you know, as far as social media stuff, and you have no time left for writing or anything else. I mean, that's why I always say you have to really discipline yourself to keep your author marketing in a window. So And that's why I write on a computer if it's not connected to the internet. I don't want to be distracted by any of those kind of concerns, you know, and I, you know, set aside definitive time for, you know, as far as the marketing and promotion activity. And because, yeah, that can spiral out of hand. And that's something that, you know, that was one of the things that I was unexpected for me is how quickly sometimes that can spiral out of hand to the point you find you're working yourself, you know, into the ground, and that's not healthy. And, you know,
well, I'm glad
still
I'm helping you
with
that.
Little bit. It does happen. It's easy to happen. But
I'm glad I'm helping you with that.
You got to keep some balance, and you don't want to have all your eggs in one basket either. You definitely want to keep some diversification in your marketing approaches and social media networks that you use, because it like Michael said, it does change, and it will crop up out of nowhere. And even little things too, like Twitter, what they changed to 280 characters. That's huge. Yeah, the kind of post that you can do with 280 characters is massively different in the way you approach that than it was with 140, and that's a whole sea change just within the, you know, within one network. And so I mean, you have to keep up with this stuff. It's a bit of a trial sometimes. But I can say I do like 280 better than 140, a lot more.
Yeah.
I can always write a few more things in and include a couple more hashtags, so that's what does not hurt. But we're coming up on the last few minutes of the show, so what direction do you guys want to go in for the last few minutes?
Okay. Update on our current works.
Well, we got one from Michael.
Yep.
I know Daniel's been writing away like a very productive creative.
James, you're about ready to get your audiobooks and audio readings started, aren't you, Daniel?
Yeah, I got my equipment in today, and today I spent working on trying to figure out how to work it and stuff like that.
Programs and whatnot.
Well, programs is part of it, but the equipment itself, I've never, you know, done a soundboard or anything like that. So I'm trying to find out exactly how that operates. It's very simple operation to it, but it's, you know, tweaking it in, figuring out what makes it sound the best and different things like that.
Yeah.
With my voice. So getting all that, you know, set up and figured out a little bit, and be able to start a podcast on doing readings for other people's books in it and reviews on their books. And, you know, starting out with some 7-Star Press books and venturing out to some other books too.
It will be a magical experience.
Right now, my goal is to read 52 books along with writing 3, so it'll be an interesting thing this year.
When I get mine done, I'll send it to you.
Okay.
Whenever that may be. Don't look forward to it anytime soon.
Well, don't
Daniel
give me
does
no
such
tone.
A good job. He does such a good job. He'll wake up one day and have this UPS truck pull up, and then another one behind it, and there'll be like 2 trucks filled with people sending him books. And then he'll be like, "Okay, yes, I've spread too thin now."
Yeah. Right now, you know, some days I feel like I've spread myself too thin to start with. So, but it, you know, it's what it is. Like on the 21st this month, I've got a podcast that I'm going to be doing with Rippercast on Skype, and then that's in the morning time, and then that afternoon I've got a book signing at Battleground South Cigars in Columbia, Tennessee, so we'll...
Yeah, and Rippercast podcast, that's huge, so congrats on that, because that's
They're doing one on Ripper Fiction, and they wanted me to join in on that one. So,
yeah, I couldn't ask for a more perfect fit. let's talk about lasering in on your perfect audience there. That's going to be really cool to hear how that goes. And okay, we covered Michael, and then Will, go ahead and let us, how are you doing on your works?
I wrote a sentence today, but that's about it.
Well, hey.
I've got a nightmare sequence planned that I'm maybe able to get in pretty soon. So.
Very cool. Very cool.
That's fun.
Yeah, I'm as far as my end goes, I'm writing a lot, doing short fiction and then working on a one of the novels in my Fires in Eden series, and currently have my first YA novel is off with the editor right now, so I'm waiting the verdict on that one. So hopefully that'll pass muster. I do think it was at least I handed in pretty clean copy. I don't think there are any messes there, but we'll see how it goes. And
hopefully you'll be able to recommend me a good editor when the time comes.
Oh, yeah, we know one or two.
So. Then I've just got to work up a column, and that'll be it.
But I'm gonna be working a lot of writing, and of course my days are always filled with SMSR Press and Imaginarium activity. We've got a lot brewing in that front. We got a lot of blog tours coming up. We've got a lot of things gonna be rolling out for the convention, and then the Imaginarium Initiative
big
is
bloggers.
Taking some big step this month too. Finally getting the Imaginarium Initiative activities underway this end of this month. So all systems go, for sure. Even if I appear quiet on my social media, it's because I'm chugging on getting all this stuff laid in place. And, it's definitely a busy and pretty exciting time. And yeah, you're right. We're looking forward to working with a lot of new book bloggers. We love the book blog community and love engaging them, talking with them, and get a real good feedback on, titles you're working with if you're a press. I mean, for sure, you definitely get a good sense of what they're thinking. And so I'm looking forward to working with a whole lot more in the next couple of months. So it should be pretty exciting. Yeah, Michael will be having his book read by a lot of new folks too, because we just had a whole slew that started working with us on our review and blog hosting side.
Hope
so.
They don't cut you up too bad. I know a couple of mine definitely might be interested.
I'm confident in this bunch. I think they'll pass muster. But it's good to have a big burst of, and we're going to be continuing to grow that family more, the book blog community that we work with. So that's definitely keeping me hopping. Holly, she's always chugging with things, and I'm always working alongside her on developing our social media and all. And I know she's been kind of ill lately, but she's been quietly back at it. So, and she will be, I think, on the air next week. So we're good.
Excellent.
Yeah, we're in good form.
We have to hear from her again.
Yeah,
last few minutes. Get her on the air now.
Oh, I think she actually went off to take a shower, so it'll be pretty hard for me to pull that one off. I'm tied down to my setup here. It'll be an interesting segment if I went mobile here. But yeah, we've got about 60 seconds left, so next week we will definitely have another Star Chamber show at 9 p.m. Eastern. And definitely follow us on Twitter and Facebook for sure for the Star Chamber show. And it's just all one word, facebook.com/Star Chamber Show or Twitter @Star Chamber Show. You can follow us both of those places. And definitely enjoyed tonight's discussion. We got in quite a lot of good, easygoing discussion on this topic. And great to hear from you, Michael.
Yeah, it was good to be back.
he made it. We've come to the end here. So, thank you.
I'm so excited there.
Thank you to everybody for listening, and we will see you in a week in another Star Chamber show. But good night for now.
Good night to you,
Dave.